I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. We can begin again, George W. Bush told the Republican convention last night. After all the shouting, after all the scandal, all the bitterness and all the broken faith, he said, it won't be long now. Bush's dismissal of his fellow baby boomers Clinton and Gore had a sting both political and personal.
Our current president embodied the potential of a generation. So many talents, so much charm, such great skill. But in the end, to what end? This administration had its moment. They've had their chance. They have not led. We will.
George Bush introduced himself last night as somebody who lacks the polish of Washington and some of the ambition of his opponent, but he said he's ready for this fight.
Their war room is up and running, but we are ready. Their attacks will be relentless, but they will be answered. We are facing something familiar, but they're facing something new. We are now the party of ideas and innovation, the party of idealism and inclusion, the party of a simple and powerful hope. My fellow citizens, we can begin again.
The heir of the heir of Ronald Reagan said he meant to take their party in a new direction, and he said it with a scene of jailhouse despair and the revival fervor of a church meeting. He said, we are all diminished when any among us feel trapped, worthless, and hopeless.
When these problems are not confronted, it builds a wall within our nation. On one side are wealth, technology, education, and ambition. On the other side of that wall are poverty and prison, addiction and despair. And my fellow Americans, we must tear down that wall.
Connection listeners, would you buy a new beginning from that man? Can you reconcile the compassion with the conservatism of George W. Bush? Our phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. Kevin Phillips, the political analyst and writer, the man who helped Richard Nixon invent the Southern Strategy in 1968, whose last book is The Cousins War, Religion, Politics, and the Triumph of Anglo-America, joins us by phone. Kevin Phillips, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Chris.
What did you make of the speech? Was it plausible? Was it convincing?
Well, I think you have to look at it on two levels. The first is that for people who don't immerse themselves in all of this, I think it was reasonably successful and fairly well done. For people who have seen these for 30 years, who know the phoniness behind the words, and I'm not saying Democrat or Republican, this is even more than 30 years, of just conjuring these things up, and they work at the convention and then they're forgotten. I think he's succeeded pretty well on the first level with people that don't appreciate what goes on behind the scenes. That was sort of like the first blending of a Pepsi commercial and a convention. It struck all these happy talk notes, and they probably mean some of it. I think certainly George W. means some of it. But lurking behind this is the fact that you have, first, on the Republican side, the only all-oil ticket in American history, two people from the oil industry, which is not notable for compassion. You don't automatically think of oil executives for better kindergartens and things like that. And then secondly, you have a whole inner core of Republican objectives, and they don't really include any of this. What they include is tax cuts, both in top rates and getting rid of inheritance taxes, keeping the whole political system safe for big money, opening up international markets, but also international labor, Mexico and China, cheap labor for American corporations, pushing Social Security in the direction of more stock market involvement and privatization. And all of this sort of thing, it's not the same as the Pepsi commercial they put on. But I think most average voters will have responded to the Pepsi commercial. I'd be interested to know how many people even watched it. But of those who did, I suspect it was fairly successful.
This is really interesting. And I want to, it bears emphasis that you've been on that Republican side all your life. And you're not, I don't think of you as a cynic either. I think of you as a historian. But the question you raise really is whether in however many weeks there are till November, that Pepsi commercial can be penetrated, whether the other side of that story can be told. What do you think? Who's going to tell it? I mean, the Gore attacks on Bush will be about as sort of obvious as the Bush attacks on Gore. Who's going to penetrate that question? As you say, the first all-oil ticket in American history, an under-agenda of getting rid of inheritance taxes, making the world safe for big money and cheap labor. I mean, coming from Kevin Phillips, that's a very strong description. Who's going to tell that story to the masses?
Well, I think the fundamental weakness of the debate is going to be the fundamental weakness of the campaign. You have not simply a Republican nominee who's somebody who may not be the greatest heavyweight and owes his political role to inheritance. You have a Democratic vice president who is the inheritor of one of the sleaziest presidents in memory and also of a father who was a senator. Al Gore is not the knight errant who's going to topple George Bush out of the saddle. He's another fellow who's lucky if he can hold up his lance.
Well, you have, you know, what struck me in the Bush speech last night briefly was that it was a very good speech. It seemed to me draw a perfectly plausible, engaging picture of a new politician. But nobody else in the world, even his wife, would have told George Bush's story that way. He really thinks he's just a kid from the community in West Texas. He seems almost delusional on the point that he's the son of a president, grandson of a senator, who was eased into Andover and Yale and baseball and everything every step of the way. I mean, who believes the Pepsi commercial, and who's going to remind folks politely of that other story, or do they know it?
Well, I think the most effective potential opponents of George W. are not Al Gore, but they're Ralph Nader and Pat Buchanan, because they will raise all these issues. I mean, Al Gore actually, in a small way, is the third link to big oil, because his family had ties to Arm & Hammer and Occidental Petroleum.
Yes.
And I just, to me, Al Gore represents the same kind of bankruptcy, really, that George W. represents, and I can't see how the Republican-Democratic race can create the possibility for understanding the larger dynamics here. I think it has to come from Nader and Buchanan.
Well, that's interesting, and maybe that's reassuring. I wonder, though, you know, the networks don't tell, there's no story to tell at these conventions, and they don't tell that sort of obvious other side of the coin that you're spelling out: big oil, big money, cheap labor, cut death taxes, as he said. We don't have a populist press in this country. Do we need a new one to tell this story?
I think it's going to be very difficult to tell this story through the existing media. There's obviously a degree to which they open up to these issues, and you can find them periodically and with some regularity. But in the sense of developing a strong thrust of these views being articulated, they won't. And that's, again, why I come back to Nader and Buchanan, given the fact that they both have some prominence. I mean, forgetting Buchanan's problems for the moment, I think he will wind up with a nomination. He and Nader can command an audience and command decent levels of media attention. I don't see it getting there any other way. The press will never put it on the front pages or lead portions of a broadcast.
There's another thing about the speech last night that I found fascinating, and that was the redemption theme that went all the way through it. The country can be redeemed. I've been redeemed. I've been forgiven. I found grace when I need it. We can start again. It had a revival quality about it, which I think probably he feels very authentically. It's also becoming one of the great cliches of recovery, every kind of recovery in American politics. How did you score that piece?
Well, there again, that's a bunch of humbug, but everybody...
Which is the humbug?
In George's case. The humbug is that Americans don't want a new beginning when they have all the things that we can measure, ranging from stock markets at high levels to the longest business cycle anybody can remember, and for that matter, lotteries and adult videos and all the other stuff they like. If they wanted a new beginning, they could have impeached a fellow who basically trashed the Oval Office. They didn't want to do it. I'm not sure. New Beginning. New Beginning is a fraud, but it's part of a fraud that's become accepted vernacular in American politics. New everything, from new nationalism to new deal to new frontier. I mean, this is the new nothingness, the new meringue, I suppose, could be this administration, potential administration.
But you were in on that new Nixon. George Bush is talking about sort of a new me. I mean, lurking behind that story was, I was a bad boy, and I'm back. Look at me. I'm okay now. Did you not feel that? I mean, I thought he was talking about himself all of that time. What do you make of that?
I think that's true, Chris. I think he was talking about himself, and he's addressing a religious theme there, talking to people who, some of them may be a little marginal in supporting his campaign, but I think he does believe that. And I think that he feels that Americans want to hear about a new moral America. They don't necessarily just want to vote for it if it gets in the way of not having the SUVs and then the 401ks and the adult videos. But it's nice to have the rhetoric. It's nice to play the game.
What did you make of the policy points here? And particularly, I mean, you're a student of the way parties change and remake their constituencies. What about all that outreach on schools, Social Security, you know, prescription drugs for old folks? A real sort of angry attack there on homelessness, social isolation, racial discrimination. What's he up to?
Well, there's a lot of talk, but no specifics. On the drug program, they have an alternative to the Democratic one, but if you look at the polls, people want the more sweeping one and trust the Democrats more. The rest of it is mostly meringue, as I say it. It works very well because you can't go in there and analyze this the way the television covers it. You can only do sweeping little commentaries and on the nuances and was it successful or not and so forth. But no, he's got a rhetoric, which to me is interesting. You've seen elements of this in the Republican Party before. I have to sort of close this off, but the last point to make really is that we had another Bush who was calling himself the education president, and nothing happened, capital N, capital H. I mean, George Sr. played that number relentlessly, and the editorialists just mused on it because that wasn't what he did. He did capital gains. He did defending the Kuwaiti oil interests. And you have to go back and look at realities, not puffery that you get out of an overgrown infomercial. That's what these were.
Kevin Phillips, would you stand by for a question or two?
Chris, just two or three more minutes.
Fair enough. 1-800-423-8255. Amber is on the line.
Yes.
Welcome, Amber.
Good morning. I didn't watch last night, but I just wanted to make a few quick points because I have seen a lot of the convention. I'm not sure if it's delusional redemption or redemption of the delusional, but I'm curious who Saddam's going to vote for. At any rate, I didn't tune in last night because anyone who's read the newspaper or turned into the radio or TV pretty much knew what was going to be in the speech, but I did watch over the week because I wanted to get a
What did you learn? Do you buy the story?
Well, I learned a couple of things. I learned some that was good and was bad. I learned that, you know, these rich Republicans from oil-based Yale through Texas now speak Spanish so they can talk to their maids better. I learned that they like black men who wear uniforms and take orders and don't shake the boat too much. But on the down, I also learned that they're very forgiving of people who screw up until their 40s and then have their daddies bail them out of it. But the part of this that bothered me was this convention was more Clinton than Bill Clinton is, and that's truly scary for people who went there to tell...
Meaning what? We were talking to Dick Morris yesterday. Pin down the Clinton factor.
Dick Morris was perfect because this campaign was practically written by Dick Morris, and that's what's frightening. It's about nothing. It's about the appearance. It's about the well-worded language. It's Clinton. This is Clinton's ultimate revenge that the man who beat him, ironically, now has a son running for office who is more Clinton than Clinton. Is. And I, who didn't want Clinton to begin with, but ultimately came to support him because I'd rather support him than the New York Times, do not look forward to 4 years of Clinton from the other side of the political aisle.
Kevin Phillips, I want your verdict on this diversity kick. What about it in the Republican Party?
Well, let me say quickly that I think the lady should have a newspaper column. I think she's exactly right. I think what
she's got a radio show right here. Go ahead.
Shallowness has begotten shallowness, and the Republicans are replying with Dick Morris claptrap, while underneath they prepare to play the same games that they've always played, for better or worse. Sometimes those games are worthwhile, sometimes they're not. But I think that because that is true, and I think it is true, you just sort of have to say, get the meringue off the pie. What is the pie? And people have really gotten to the point where they don't pay much attention to what the pie is, and that's just a fundamental problem. And it's true on both sides. I don't see how the Democrats are going to be able to make too much out of this. It'll be a close race, but it shouldn't be a close race, given how well off the country is, quote unquote, and the weakness of Bush, who has no preparation for this job. So it'll be a close race because we've got two choices of the same thing. One, as the lady said, is the heir of Clinton stylistically, and the second is the heir of Clinton politically. It's a horrible fate.
Kevin Phillips, we love you. You're great. Thank you enormously for joining us. Kevin Phillips.
Thanks, Chris.
Of the emerging Republican majority in 1968, most recently, he wrote The Cousins' War, Religion, Politics, and the Triumph of Anglo-America. 1-800-423-8255 makes the George W. Bush acceptance speech connection. Well, 1-800-423-TALK. John Fund joins us by phone, member of the Wall Street Journal editorial board and a columnist for MSNBC. John Fund, score the speech. And is it good enough for the Journal editorial board?
Well, the speech was a tremendous rhetorical tour de force. It clearly did not want to overburden the audience with specifics, but he laid out a few simple themes, very Reagan-esque in many respects, and down to the part where he basically drew a contrast or comparison with Reagan's tear down the wall speech and said, we have a domestic wall that we have to tear down. Clearly there was a lot of rhetorical flourish there that I think some people are allowed to be skeptical about. But this is an optimistic Reagan-like party. It's going to be an election on character, leadership. And Al Gore, who normally should benefit from the relative peace and prosperity we have, I think is quaking in his boots today because he suddenly realizes this is not just a rich kid from Texas whose daddy bailed him out, as the previous caller said. This is a very formidable, skilled political animal.
Is this a Wall Street Journal kind of conservative, or how different is he?
Well, people who actually read the Wall Street Journal editorial page than just rely on the stereotype should note that we have been writing about school choice, about empowerment, about charitable choice programs, getting away from government bureaucracy and lending more hope and opportunity to faith-based institutions. We have been talking about that for 15 or 20 years. We are entirely comfortable with this, and this is not a departure. This is an affirmation of what we've been writing.
How about tear down that wall? I mean, I would have thought that compassion was a little out of hand there for the Wall Street Journal.
Well, I would simply repeat what I said. For those people who actually read the Wall Street Journal editorial page then rely on the stereotype of what we write or what we think.
Read it religiously. Go ahead.
Well, I think you will have noticed I wrote several columns this week, for example, talking about that how government can keep body and soul together. Government can write checks to people, but government cannot offer hope and help and true compassion, which has to be on a one-to-one basis. And that's what George W. Bush was talking about. And no, I mean, compassion does not necessarily mean spending money. It means actually finding effective ways to help people rather than just say, I gave it the office.
He calls himself, or he calls his party, the party of ideas and innovation, as well as idealism and inclusion. What are the ideas and innovations that strike you as interesting here?
Well, taking a Social Security program that was created in 1935 and updating it for the financial innovations and this financial sophistication that people now have, taking a Medicare program, which is basically a standard-issue Blue Cross plan of 1965, one size fits all, and updating it with choice and opportunities so people will have a menu of choices rather than just a single bland cafeteria meal.
This doesn't, I mean, that doesn't sound like ideas and innovation exactly. It sounds to me like putting the best face on tweaking that we can, but
I think when you have a private retirement account with your name on it in which you own the assets, and I think that when you and I turn 65 and we don't have to go through the kind of bureaucracy and red tape and we can have all kinds of options for medical care that aren't available to people now, I think we will personally in our own lives view that as more than tweaking. I think we will view that as substantive.
Should I can't run the risk of calling it a risky tweaking scheme, can I?
Well, I think that was the most effective line that George W. Bush had last night. Al Gore is
the risky anti-candle scheme. Yeah, that was a good line.
Well, actually, one line that he dropped from the prepared text of his speech was, remember when he started out by saying, well, you know, and if Al Gore had been there when the Internet was invented.
Yeah, he did drop that out.
Well, he would have continued to say, and I understand that he actually was there.
Right. Well, he got the laugh without delivering the punchline, so he quit while he was ahead.
Well, exactly, which I think shows how effective the speech was.
Well, it tells you that the field is mined against Al Gore. People know that Internet stuff. They know an awful lot about.
And some of that is unfair. If you actually read the transcript of what Al Gore said about the Internet, I think it was a slip of the tongue rather than a slip of arrogance. But I will say this. Al Gore is going to respond to this. And here's what I think is going to happen. I think the Republicans have, and I will agree this much with Kevin Phillips, have had a very effective Democratic-sounding convention. The Democrats, especially if Al Gore picks John Kerry, a Vietnam War hero, they're going to make the argument, well, the Republicans talk the talk on patriotism and American values, but we walk the walk. We actually went to Vietnam. I think the Democrats may respond by having a Republican-sounding convention.
I'm glad you heard Kevin Phillips. Let's get a little bit real on what he calls the Pepsi commercial here, and I think a lot of people could enjoy the speech and also realize it was a Pepsi commercial. He says it's the first all-oil ticket in American history, and it is. This has got to be difficult.
On November 8th, bring me the names of the people from the VNS exit poll who cite the big oil ticket as a primary, even secondary reason for casting their vote, and I'll send a sum of money to the favorite charity of your choice. That's not going to show up in the exit polls, and anyone who thinks that is fooling themselves.
Well, it's not going to be an issue, but it's going to frame everything. We know where these guys come from, and we know. No?
And as if Al Gore does not, you know, picks John Edwards of North Carolina, as if everybody would go into the polls and say, well, John Edwards is a trial lawyer. Al Gore is in hock to the trial lawyers. The trial lawyers are dominating the Democratic ticket. They're writing the checks for the Democratic Party. We're going to vote against the trial lawyers. That's not going to happen. And people are not going to go into the polling booth and say this is a big oil ticket. The bottom line is the people who care about that, Christopher, are the people who are already voting against George W. Bush. We're talking about swing voters. And I'll be honest with you. If you look at the polls on the recent run-up in gas prices, especially in the Midwest, government policies were blamed far more than the oil companies.
Well, that may be
I can send you the polls.
I don't doubt it. But, I mean, a lot of people believe chickens have lips. I mean,
Christopher, look, fundamental rule of politics number one. People who care about something like that are going to be already voting for Al Gore or Ralph Nader. The swing and the independent voters are interested in other things, and they're not interested in the backgrounds of the candidates. They're actually interested in what they say and what they propose and whether or not it will have a meaningful change in their lives for the better.
Well, that is another question that Kevin Phillips raised. I mean, there's a lot of music here, but not a lot of commitment to spend money on things or to do things. You say spending money isn't important, but that's one way people measure this. So, John, I'd like you to stand by for a call or two. 1-800-423-8255 on the morning after George Bush's self-presentation last night. 1-800-423-TALK. Meg is on the line.
Hi.
Welcome,
I'm really baffled by what people keep talking about, the character issue, or that George W. Bush is honorable or that he has a decent character. I guess I just don't personally see it, and I don't understand why he keeps harping on it, or even the guy from the Wall Street Journal was harping on it.
When did I harp on it?
Well, you said at the very beginning that he was a man who's had some character and some integrity.
I didn't say that.
Well, I swear you had, or at least somebody else has had, and I just don't understand where the whole character. I mean, I obviously understand the foible.
You mean the Bush
character.
Offensive on Clinton, or but who?
Well, but his own character. I guess I just don't see anything particularly honorable or wonderful about him or about any of the Bushes. And
well,
they have this great sort of character issue in their favor. They're this the great family that has this great honorable thing going on for themselves.
Well, I think there are three things that fair-minded people would say. They would say the following. George W. Bush has some things in his background that people are allowed to be skeptical about. I would also say that his father, George Bush, who was defeated for president by Bill Clinton in 1992, now ranks much, much higher in the polls than he did when he left office, and frankly ranks higher in esteem than Bill Clinton does, in part because of Bill Clinton's actions during his two terms. I would also say that Al Gore, let's put it this way, even Al Gore's acquaintances and friends will concede that Al Gore often has an indirect and elliptical approach to the truth. And there are going to be character considerations on both sides. Both people are imperfect human beings, and the voters are going to have to choose. But for those who think that George W. Bush has character problems, if you look at the internal surveys and the public opinion polls, Al Gore is not someone who is very likable to the American people. George W. Bush may have his problems, but you cannot argue that this man does not have a sunny, optimistic disposition, which is what I did say at the beginning. I did not mention character integrity, and is someone who is extremely likable and is much more trustworthy, according to the polls, than Al Gore.
John Fine, your points are taken, and I think I have to get you off the hook. I don't think you did dwell on character, certainly not harp on it. Thank you, John Fund of the Wall Street Journal editorial board and MSNBC columnist, too. We'll be back after a short break. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. From Boston. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. We're talking about George W. Bush accepting his Republican nomination in Philadelphia last night. The phone's 1-800-423-8255. Larry DuBose is on the line, the editor of the Texas Observer, co-author with Molly Ivins of Shrub, The Short But Happy Political Life of George W. Bush. We're also joined by Elizabeth Mitchell, author of W, Revenge of the Bush Dynasty, two biographers of George W. Bush. You've had to get your own heads around this man's story before. What parts of your own books would you rewrite after listening to his own version of this saga? Start with you, Elizabeth Mitchell.
Well, the thing that impressed me the most, I have to say, just on a pure political level, was that he was able to transform Clinton into this do-nothing president, which is, I think, a tactic that I never would have anticipated from the research that I had done. You know, basically, they had switched the Republican rhetoric from saying that Democrats are the people who spend too much and try too many new programs, and instead said that he had defaulted on his promises and basically sat around the White House for the last 8 years. So I found that very surprising.
Lou DuBose, what did you think? And well, especially the way he presents his own autobiography.
Yeah, well, Christopher, I would rewrite the entire book. We'd have to go back and start from the beginning. I mean, here is a son of privilege whose patrimony was initially, he says, a 1970 old Cutlass and $20,000 from his educational trust. And he goes to Midland, Texas. And he loses, you know, something like $3.1 million, according to SEC filings, of other people's money. He walks away with $800,000, buys a baseball team, buys into a baseball team at 2%, and is portrayed as the owner, and is the managing partner sitting in a box seat, and then runs for governor with a huge amount of money behind him. You know, this and that Oldsmobile and that $20,000 was his log cabin. And then I would say that what is really important is look at the record in Texas. I mean, Michael Dukakis had a record, and it cost him the presidency. And if we had a two-party system, and if candidates, if the candidate in the opposing party would, if Al Gore would make the record in Texas an issue, I think that it would put the truth test to the speech.
He said his account of those 6 years were, as governor, I've made difficult decisions and stood by them under pressure. I've been where the buck stops in business and in government. I've been a chief executive who sets an agenda, sets big goals, and rallies people to believe and achieve them, etc. Rewrite that.
Well, he sets big goals and did rally people. I mean, he went to Midland and he with $20,000 and there was a series of failed companies. Each time he set big goals and was bailed out by big money. A New York investor by the name of Peter Uzzilli comes in and buys 10% of one of his failing companies for $1 million. The company had $360,000 in book value. So this guy buys $36,000 in book value for $1 million. He's investing in political futures. I don't see any big goals in Texas. I see a scripted candidate with 4 points, and a very talented, as was pointed out earlier, politician. But there's been no big agenda. You can't have a big agenda when you don't believe in government. The big agenda is dismantling government, and that's the unstated agenda. That's the unstated goal. But, you know, we're 50th in per capita spending in Texas. We're 49th per capita government spending on all programs.
You're 50th, is that right?
We're 49th in spending on the environment and first in volume of pollution. Now, George Bush did not create that, but over two terms of governor, he had an age of prosperity in which to address it. Instead, he gave $3 billion back in small, insignificant tax breaks to property owners, and that essentially is robbing the Treasury of a state that doesn't yet have fully funded universal kindergarten. I repeat that, not fully funded kindergarten. This is really extraordinary.
I'd like Lou DuBose and Elizabeth Mitchell, I'd like you both, all of us, just let's listen to what for me was the kind of emotional core of the speech last night, in which he talked about a scene and painted a very quick, effective picture in Marlin, Texas. Let's listen.
A couple of years ago, I visited a juvenile jail in Marlin, Texas, and talked with a group of young inmates. They were angry, wary kids. All had committed grown-up crimes. Yet when I looked in their eyes, I realized some of them were still little boys. Toward the end of the conversation, one young man, about 15 years old, raised his hand and asked a haunting question. What do you think of me? He seemed to be asking, like many Americans who struggle, is there hope for me? Do I have a chance? And frankly, do you, a white man in a suit, really care what happens to me?
Lou DuBose, Elizabeth Mitchell, your biographers of this man, where did that story come from? Did it come from a speechwriter's file or somewhere in his own memory or heart? Elizabeth Mitchell.
That actually it originally appeared in a Texas Observer article, I believe, and then the speechwriters picked it up because it's such an effective story. What had been happening was he was campaigning, running around the country, talking about juveniles who commit crime, terming them thugs, and, you know, sort of speaking in this sort of wild rhetoric. And then when he went to the prison, he did have this kind of moment where he reconsidered, and it's been played up over the years to be this a moment of epiphany. But the thing is, and he did sort of soften his stance a little bit on some of the more strident views about juvenile justice, but I mean, you still have to look at the fact that in Texas there are more, you know, people executed than any other state in the union, and that if you look at the website for the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, it has things like, you know, fun facts. There were 6 brothers executed in Texas, and you know, sort of this kind of lightness about some of the things that are more serious in the punitive system.
So that, you say that Marlin, Texas story appeared first in the Texas Observer. What, Lou DuBose, what was the spin on it in the Observer's telling?
Well, the story, I think it's a Bill Clinton, it is a Bill Clinton feel your pain story, looking at, into these kids' eyes. But at the time we were writing about the fact that he ran a tough on crime, tough love campaign the first time, his first campaign when he defeated Ann Richards, at a time that a fear campaign, sort of a Willie Horton campaign. At the time the crime rates were dropping, built a bunch of prisons, but Ann Richards built a bunch of prisons. And I think part of what this is, Karl Rove's genius, Karl Rove, of course, being Bush's chief political strategist, and realizing that you can only be so tough on crime, and then the public begins to see you as mean-spirited. And, you know, there's a wealth of Republican polling that it's time to end the Gingrich meanness. He was admirably, I mean, he was kept off stage for the entire convention. He was trolling for interviews, and that's what this is all about. It's compassionate conservatism. It's putting a pretty face on a pretty harsh policy.
But I will point out, I think that this compassionate conservatism is a remarkable sea change from the last Republican conventions. I mean, I think that's the one thing that, you know,
absolutely,
in talking about all this fluffy rhetoric, this is hugely different than you know, particularly 92, but even 96, even, you know, as much as everyone can be cynical about the parade of African Americans in a party that doesn't have a very strong representation of African Americans voting along party lines, that this is the way you begin building that. And I think actually that is pretty remarkable.
I would have said that the compassion conservatism ratio was, I don't know, 60-40 last night. I mean, it certainly reached its, the compassion side is at a high watermark. What is the Texas balance in George Bush, would you say? Is it, where is it, 2080, 1090?
I'm sorry, the Texas?
The relationship of compassion to conservatism in this man's fundamental makeup.
In his fundamental makeup, I would say it's more what was represented at the convention. In Texas, he's not the one who's entirely in control of the Texas government. So basically, you know, he is guided in large part by his lieutenant governor. So, in a way that the record in Texas, you know, sadly for voters, is a hard one to judge George Bush on, because, I mean, it more than anything speaks to the fact that he doesn't have a great amount of experience in actually creating agenda and guiding it through. What he can do is use the governorship as a bully pulpit. And to a certain extent, I would say that he has expressed, you know, compassion in the bully pulpit of Texas.
Our guests are two biographers of George W. Bush. Elizabeth Mitchell wrote W, The Revenge of the Bush Dynasty. Lou DuBose co-wrote with Molly Ivins Shrub, The Short but Happy Political Life of George W. Bush. Give them a call at 1-800-423-8255. The W connection on the morning after his acceptance speech. Brian is on the line.
Hi.
Hello, Brian.
Hi. Here's my take on compassionate conservatism last night, which had me so riled up that my wife had to go in the other room because I was, you know, yelling obscenities at high volume. This is just wolves in sheep's clothing. And there are two things going on. One, they're saying this is a return to Reagan, this is a return to moral values, and if it's a return to Reagan, it's a return to Reagan because it will just convince me once and for all that Americans do not know how to read, and that we'll put another moron in the White House whose advisors run the country, and he just looks pretty up in the front of the TV cameras. Here's the deal. Compassionate conservatism. Last night, the thing that made me most angry was that they had this California Republican Latino politician get up and give a talk in Spanish, subtitle it, and then have the audacity to pretend like this isn't the party that has tried to push immigrants south of the border, that has tried to take away citizenship rights for their children, that has tried to take away education rights for them.
Brian, what was your wife saying all this time?
It's not that she didn't agree with me. It's just that she couldn't believe I was getting so mad about it. It makes me think, do people not know how to think? Do they not know how to remember what it was like? You know, he's an education president, or his father was. I mean, his father and Reagan were the people who ignored Brown versus Board of Education for 12 years.
In terms of the immigration issues, I mean, George W., the one thing that you could say is that he wrote an editorial to the New York Times during this sort of deep fervor of the Republican revolution, Newt Gingrich's revolution, and said and the title of it was Don't Mess with Mexico, and it was basically about to stop the immigration bashing, and that there were and that the Republican Party had gotten out of hand on this, and in terms of also legislation that was being introduced. So to a certain extent, he's been more liberal, let's say, on that issue than his other Republican colleagues.
Lou DeBose, do you want to comment?
I would agree with Elizabeth on that. I would agree with much of what the caller said about George Bush. But you know, one of many reasons that Pete Wilson is not here tonight making an acceptance speech was Pete Wilson's divisive attack on Mexican-Americans who kept his state and continue to keep his state running at a time that when the demographics of the nation were shifting and there's a big voting bloc out there, and George Bush recognizes that. And he has, you know, to his credit, he has tried to learn to speak Spanish. No, you know, gringo politician in Texas does that. And he, you know, said to Leonel Sosa, the ad consultant in San Antonio of his gubernatorial campaign, this last gubernatorial campaign, if you say you need 1 million, spend 2 million. If you say you need 2 million, spend 4 million. Give me a perfect Hispanic campaign, which was the springboard to this, you know, to the convention of love that followed the convention of hate, and the convention of inclusiveness that followed the convention where Pat Buchanan brought the House and the party down in '92. And so he's not that sort of candidate. But the other issues, this really compassionate conservatism. I mean, read the books. Marvin Alasky, I don't know where he's been for the past couple of days. But to be frank, he is an embarrassment. He's an embarrassment to the campaign. He's the man who gave Newt Gingrich the line about orphanages, and his whole book is a nostalgia. Much of his work is a nostalgia for charity and 19th century almshouses. You don't hear much about that.
Thousand points of light and all that.
Yes,
1001.
The thousand. Yeah, right. This was 1001. You don't hear much about putting people in orphanages. But that's him and Myron Magnet, who's a Manhattan Institute scholar. They provide the intellectual underpinning for this. And you don't read their books and before you vote.
Fair enough. 1-800-423-8255. The Morning After George W. Connection. Lee is on the line.
Hi, Chris. I was intrigued by all the oil, calling this the oil ticket. I just wanted to just be sure that everyone realizes that Vice President Gore, over $1 million of his personal assets and probably the single largest holding in his account is British Petroleum. So I guess it isn't all oil.
Kevin Phillips beat you to the punch. I mean, there's oil in that Gore fortune, Occidental Petroleum, Arm & Hammer, in his father's past, too.
Yeah, but getting back to...
So we only need one more to make it the final four.
Yeah.
The oil
yeah.
final four.
Yeah, except it's a real difference when if you're trying to complain about Cheney, who ran Schlumberger, which is... a company that invests in the technology to extract oil and has been pioneering in some of the more important ways of drilling at angles and getting more out of initial wells and all of that sort of good stuff. But the real thing I got out of the convention, and I think everybody calls it meringue and everything else and tries to say inclusive, but there's a real difference, I think, between conservatives and liberals, and the conservatives look at a group of people and call them Americans, and liberals look at a group of people and want to call them by types or put them into groups and deal with them as groups. And there's been a lot of pitting against one group against the other, and if this group has it, this group can't have it.
You like George W. Bush, Lee?
I was.
Tell us what is it you like about him?
Well, actually, I was rather wasn't very impressed at all with him during the primary season, and I saw a George Bush, give a speech and express himself, and pick people that are there from a position of governing. I mean, Cheney wasn't picked for the massive 3 electoral votes of Wyoming. he was picked because he was a competent guy ready to step in as president if anything were to happen, and to be a real source of advice and knowledge. He's a rather accomplished individual.
What's the direction that you like in George Bush's plan for the country?
Well, I think the one thing about responsibility that I liked was that, I mean, I own my own business. I'm responsible for myself all the time. Nobody comes and gets me a job if I don't get it. No one, you know, I pay all those quarterly taxes. I provide my own health insurance. I very much feel that if I have a chance to put a little money away and have it grow and I mean, the American people are damn smart and damn good and damn creative, and if you give them the chance to do what they can do and get out of their way and get them going, and you can really do some pretty amazing things.
Let's hope you're right, Lee. Thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Bashir is on the line. Hello, Bashir.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Thank you. I enjoy always your show, and I needed to yesterday when I was listening to the speech. I was extremely moved by the speech, but I thought in next second he was going to give up all his wealth for poor people. I really did. If he does, then we are someplace. I felt like I was someplace 1,437 years ago when a man had given up everything to poor people.
Remind us, 1,437 years ago.
It was Muhammad.
Ah, yes.
He gave up everything, and he lived on a burlap he slept. But yesterday the speech was just like that. I said, oh, we are going someplace. But I know we are not going to, because it was a wonderful, sweet talk, as that lady earlier said. They love to have uniformed people come and listen to them, and they kept this nice, wonderful thing looking there, and it was very moving. Words were extremely incredible, but none of the words were coming out of his heart. It was so obvious to me that somebody else was singing these nice tunes to his ears. He had a wonderful tongue to bring it out.
He said, when I act, you will know my reasons. When I speak, you will know my heart. Can you read his heart for us?
No, I can't. The heart is that yesterday he should have said everything that is to his name in his banks and oil. It's out there for poor people, for schools, for food, for better housing. But he didn't say that. He didn't say all his what he has is in a wonderful safety deposit box someplace.
Well, we didn't.
What's he going to give to others?
We've never asked these rich men to give up their own money as a proof, Bashir. I think that may be too much. Lou DuBose, you want to get? You're not going to give up your fortune, Lou DuBose.
When the governor, when my governor begins to give up his, and you know, this is, George Bush as a Muslim or a Christian ascetic, is a stretch. Essentially though, you have, I think that Bashir's on the right road. This is about, this campaign, this 1,000 points of light is about charity, about getting the government out of the business of helping people. And, in the last legislative session, again, there was a chance to provide health insurance for 500,000 through the CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program, federal-state 3-to-1 match. And George W. fought to eliminate 200,000 kids. I don't know why. It cost the state $89 million, I'm sorry. You know, when he gave back $1.3 billion that session, if you're going to get government out of the process of helping people, then or providing certain social services, then you better make certain that they're there. His father's
answer was he had a good heart too, but he said we have more will than wallet. George W., if he ever gets the job, will have lots of money to spend on this stuff if he chooses to. Do you mean he's just going to say, I lied or I fooled you or what?
No, he won't have lots of money. I don't think he'll have lots of money to spend. The record shows that if you could plunder the treasury of the state of Texas, the lowest spending state in the nation, give back $3 billion when there is a great deal of need. And I mean, not just hunger. When he said if there were hungry people in Texas, wouldn't the governor know about it? Well, it was like Gary Hart saying, put a tail on me. Every newspaper in the state went out and found huge pockets of hunger. But there are places where there's no economic infrastructure, and some government spending would help. But if you don't believe in that quaint process of taxation, then you can't do that. You can't provide for those needs, and if you're going to privatize everything, you better make sure the private sector is capable of doing it, and the charities and the nonprofits who have already said that we're being overburdened are capable of caring for the people that the government is now providing for.
Lou DuBose and Elizabeth Mitchell, thank you enormously. We're going to read both of your books again. Shrub by Lou DuBose and W, Revenge of the Bush Dynasty by Elizabeth Mitchell, who's also a contributing editor at Newsweek. Thanks to Kevin Phillips of the Wall Street Journal and John Fund, who joined us earlier. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Mississippi's of Roxbury, serving the community and companies from their international menu for 23 years. 800-230-6789 or mississippis.com. And for Nova, enabling...